This is JAMDA On The Go, your review of the content featured in JAMDA, the research-focused monthly journal of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast.
Welcome to JAMDA On The Go. This podcast will spotlight articles from the June 2020 issue of JAMDA, the Journal of the American Medical Director Association from the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. We'll be speaking once again with JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan, and JAMDA associate editor, Dr. Mallory Brown. Dr. Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Brown is also a family physician and geriatrician at the University of North Carolina, where she is an associate professor of family medicine and the director of the residency training program. Drs. Sloan and Brown, welcome back to JAMDA On The Go.
Thank you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Today we'll be discussing the June 2020 issue of JAMDA. Dr. Sloan, I understand that this has in its theme the international nature of aging research. What can you tell us specifically about this journal and this theme?
Well, one of the JAMDA's strengths is that it's an international journal, reflecting the truly international nature of geriatric problems in general and long-term care in particular. Among the 478 manuscript submissions that our editorial office received in the first 4 months of this year, 37% came from Asia, 30% from Europe, 26% from North America, and 4% from Australia. Only 22% came from the United States, reflecting not so much a dearth of research here as a vast network of research elsewhere.
So I'm recollecting my fifth grade geography, and I believe that you're missing a couple of continents.
Well, we're not going to talk about Antarctica, but Africa and South America have not yet been hit by the tsunami of aging that's affected us. They are focusing more on maternal child health, infectious diseases, and assuring access to basic primary care. However, even in these continents, there are foci of aging research, and we can expect these to grow.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. So tell us about the June 2020 issue, and then let's dig right into our four spotlighted articles for today's review.
Well, I'll just say a couple of things about the issue itself. It contains over 20 research studies from Canada, Europe, Asia, and Australia. Among this research, there are several common themes. Every paper is a multi-author study, and half the papers in this issue were written by multinational teams. They often use similar methods, you know, like the MMSE, and sometimes the same tools that we use, like measures of health status that we are all familiar with, translated, of course, which they then have to work on to make sure that the translation fits and that they're culturally relevant.
You know, as I reflect on my society membership and watching this journal evolve over time, it's impressive to think how far it's come with regard to its international outreach and presence. And I think about the studies I've read over the years. You know, I remain convinced as a geriatrician that, you know, an older adult is an older adult, no matter what their address. But, you know, healthcare systems are different across the world. The way resources are utilized are different. Medications, for a number of reasons, either may be different or utilized in a different way. And approaches to care across the world for a variety of different reasons may be different. You know, as we think about not only these studies today, but just studies in general, you know, and your role as a co-editor-in-chief for the journal, you know, have you found that there are parallels in the care of the older adult across the world, such that findings in one country could be applicable, informative, or otherwise actionable in another country, in general, and or in the United States?
Well, Wayne, you know, it is a little tricky because older people are older people everywhere, but not only are health systems different, but cultures are different.
Right.
So when I look at a paper from another country, I ask myself, are this paper's messages generalizable to other areas of the world, and especially to the United States, because we're an American journal. You're right that problems of older people are pretty much the same, and the health systems differ a lot, but there are nuances even to that. For example, I've rejected a couple of papers from East Asia on obesity and various outcomes because there are so few obese elders in this sample that they defined BMI of 26 as obese and had virtually no one with a BMI over 30. That just was not, that would not compute here.
Right.
So I didn't see the point of putting it in the journal.
Well, it's good to know that I'm obese in Eastern Asia. Let's move on to today's papers. Dr. Brown, I understand that you're leading off with a study from the United Kingdom on oral bisphosphonate use and mortality risk following an osteoporotic fracture. What can we learn from this article?
Absolutely, Wayne. Major osteoporotic fractures are the main consequence of osteoporosis, as we know, with devastating results for the affected patients, including a significantly increased risk of mortality. We know that the risk of death increases significantly for both men and women after an osteoporotic fracture, though the reasoning still remains not very clear. The hypothesis has been made that bisphosphonates may lower the risk of mortality after a fracture. This study examined if oral bisphosphonate treatment was associated with a lower all-cause mortality risk after a non-hip major osteoporotic fracture or just a hip fracture. This cohort study, which was done in the UK, of patients over the age of 50 with an initial major osteoporotic fracture between 2000 and 2018, investigated patients receiving bisphosphonates over that time period. The study looked at a large number of patients, more than 160,000, receiving bisphosphonates. About 72% had experienced a non-hip osteoporotic fracture, where only 28% actually had a hip fracture. This study identified that current oral bisphosphonate exposure was associated with a 7% higher all-cause mortality risk after a non-hip osteoporotic fracture, but with a 28% lower mortality risk after a hip fracture. The findings that mortality rate was higher with a non-hip osteoporotic fracture were not in line with prior findings from at least two large meta-analyses. But the results are in line with hip fracture data, particularly a recent large cohort study which found similar results, which compared bisphosphonates with calcium and vitamin D. A protective effect, interestingly, was observed with a 1 in 5 year follow-up of bisphosphonate use after a major osteoporotic non-hip fracture. So this seems in line with what we know about hip fractures, but the data further muddies the water about non-hip fractures and bisphosphonates. At this point, I'm not really sure I'd make any changes in my clinical practice, but the article is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it was interesting that they noted that there was this potential for an anti-atherosclerotic effect of bisphosphonates, which I personally had not heard before. But then they specifically said in the conclusion that this was not a factor in the mortality reduction that they saw, and that there this was cause for further study. So I thought this was very interesting, at least for promulgating thought once again that medications are doing things that we are not necessarily attributing to them. Dr. Sloan, it's well understood that there are arterial wall changes that occur as normal processes of aging and the potential consequences that places itself on cardiac afterload. through the years, there have been a number of studies which have looked at blood pressure in older adults and approach and management. Tell us about this study out of Italy and out of Maryland.
Well, the paper is titled "The Impact of Stiffer Arteries on a Response to Antihypertensive Treatment," a longitudinal study in the Sardinia cohort. And I have to admire these investigators for doing the study in Sardinia, because I've always wanted to visit that island. It's apparently gorgeous. And I've never been able to do any research in similarly beautiful locations. But the paper's on arterial stiffness. That's the loss of elasticity in large arteries with age that we learned about in aging physiology.
Right.
So when the heart pumps in systole, the large arteries don't expand like they do in younger adults, releasing the blood slowly during diastole. Instead, the blood rushes at the periphery, and in diastole, the blood pressure kind of plummets. At the same time, the systolic blood pressure often rises, leading to the phenomenon of widened pulse pressure with systolic hypertension that we see in older persons.
Right.
Well, the basic researchers have found a fancier, more reproducible way of measuring arterial stiffness. It's called the carotid femoral pulse wave velocity, and it is measured non-invasively using transcutaneous Doppler probes by determining how long it takes the maximum systolic pulse wave to go from the carotid to the femoral arteries. So in this JAMDA study, researchers from Italy and Baltimore, Maryland, studied a cohort of over 6,000 volunteers from four towns on the island of Sardinia. Anyway, among this cohort, they evaluated arterial stiffness in response to our antihypertensive medications over time. Fortunately, their results were quite reassuring. They found that persons with arterial stiffness responded just as well to antihypertensive treatment as did persons without arterial stiffness. Now, if you think about it, it makes sense because antihypertensive medications work on everything but the large arteries, you know, small arteries, heart, this kind of thing. But they found that systolic hypertension and wide pulse pressures lowered the systolic blood pressure further, reducing the gap between systolic and diastolic, which is exactly what we would want.
Right.
Additionally, and this is especially encouraging, is that they found that the treatment of hypertension slowed the development or worsening of arterial stiffness as measured by pulse wave velocity. So in their discussion, they note that angiotensin II blockers, otherwise known as ARBs, have been shown in laboratory studies to help prevent or ameliorate arterial stiffness. So this is something to think about, but it's awaiting clinical studies. Bottom line is additional reinforcement for treating isolated systolic hypertension in older persons, as it may reduce progression and prevent cardiovascular disease.
You know, I recall, Dr. Sloan, one of the first things that I learned in geriatric fellowship with regard to one of our geriatric cardiologists was the influence of pulse pressure, the difference between systole and diastole, and mortality. So that there was the greater that difference, the greater the risk for mortality. So it's very interesting to see that they are looking at a decreased pulse pressure, and they are finding in truth that there's might be a decreased risk for mortality. Very, very interesting study.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post-Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post-Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
Dr. Brown, I was very interested to read the next paper out of Belgium, the Netherlands, and New York on advanced care planning. It seems to find some similarities in approach to what many of us have considered to be a universal obligation today toward understanding the goals and wishes of our patients. Tell us about it.
Absolutely, Wayne. As we know, the overall aim of advanced care planning is to increase the chance that patients receive the care that is consistent with their wishes and values, even at times when they have lost decisional capacity, and are truly unable to make or express their own choices. This is certainly important for many illnesses, but particularly for dementia, where patients most often lose their ability to express their desires as the disease progresses. Advanced care planning differs in the way it is implemented and thought of between countries, partly because of different legal frameworks across nations, or specifically nation states. The U.S. currently has a changing landscape in several states where physician-assisted dying has been legalized, or in which this option is politically and publicly debated. In both Belgium and the U.S., there are a number of available and legal health care directives. This includes an instructional advanced directive focused on refusing treatment. Here in the U.S., this is called a living will, and a directive to appoint a durable power of attorney. In Belgium, interestingly, individuals can also request euthanasia through an advanced directive in the event they would end up in an irreversible, persistent vegetative state. This study aimed to explore both engagement in, as well as understanding of, advanced care planning from the perspective of family caregivers of persons with young onset dementia, which here is defined as dementia in an individual 65 or younger. It also looked to identify potential similarities and differences in this area between Americans and Belgians with young onset dementia and their family caregivers. Using qualitative semi-structured interviews, 28 participants with various familial relationships to the patient, such as wife, husband, child, or sibling, were included. When the similarities and differences between American and Belgian family caregivers were analyzed, several sub-themes emerged. Three similarities were most striking. First, families' restricted knowledge of advanced care planning. Two, the limited communication that took place with regard to advanced directives. And three, families' recommendation to professionals to initiate advanced care planning conversations in a timely manner early on in that process of potentially a patient experiencing dementia. Three major differences also emerged. First, attention paid to those end-of-life decisions are encompassed by their respective nations' laws, and therefore they differed between U.S. and Belgian participants. Two, American caregivers placed higher emphasis on financial planning than Belgian respondents. And three, when consulting a professional for advanced directives, Belgian caregivers more commonly relied on physicians, whereas Americans relied more commonly on lawyers. Wayne, this article is definitely worth a read. The authors did an amazing job of including quotes from participants to really give a sense of their understanding and their thoughts around advanced care planning, particularly with regards to caring for their loved ones with young onset dementia. This article gives new insights to an ethically and legally charged issue with little existing data before this. It provides some reasoning behind the recommendation that generic advanced care guidelines for professionals are necessary and useful. Nevertheless, and by no means wanting to culturally stereotype, it's important to take nuances between countries into account. Conclusively, this study shows that specific distinctions and challenges in terms of advanced care planning and young onset dementia arise. Simply being aware of this can improve the dialogue and care that we provide to this population.
No, I absolutely agree. We need to be greater advocates for advanced care planning in both training, execution, and documentation. And I thought that the similarities and differences that were highlighted in this paper, as you said, were very interesting to consider. Dr. Sloan, our last article is a great segue to the previous. I was surprised to see that dementia is not considered terminal in Asian societies. This paper points to some interesting outcomes related to utilization and hospice. Tell us some more.
Well, this paper is on the trend of aggressive treatments and end-of-life care for older people with dementia after a policy change in Taiwan. Like so much of medicine, end-of-life care has been evolving continuously in my lifetime. Partly it's had to do with changing attitudes. Partly it's had to do with the evolution of practice. And part A has had to do with legal changes. The previous study illustrated all of these phenomena, the ones that Mallory just talked about. This study focuses on one issue, a legal policy change. It was conducted in Taiwan, which in the year 2000 had passed the Hospice and Palliative Care Act that reimbursed for palliative care only for patients with cancer. It's kind of how we start. As happened here in the United States, the law was later extended to chronic diseases such as COPD, CHF, liver failure, and advanced dementia. This represented the earliest implementation of a widespread hospice policy in Asia. Taiwan is also a good place to study because they have a national health system and a national database, which makes large population-based studies far easier than they are here in the United States. The study looked at two types of outcomes in persons with dementia at the end of life. And these outcomes are really interesting as a researcher. The first set of outcomes were five measures of aggressive healthcare utilization they pulled off of this big database. The measures of aggressive healthcare were emergency department visits, hospital admissions, ICU admissions, hospitalizations longer than 14 days, and death in acute care hospitals. The second set of outcomes were six measures of what they call life-sustaining treatment. Insertion of a feeding tube, artificial nutritional support, blood transfusion, hemodialysis, invasive ventilation, and CPR. These are all things that would be coded, you know, in a database. So each person received 1 point per indicator, you know, up to five for aggressiveness and up to six for life-sustaining treatment. And they're kind of cool measures, I would say, for evaluating trends in end-of-life care. So what they found was probably not surprising, but the results are from national data, so they're especially robust. Every one of the measures of aggressive healthcare utilization declined in the 4 years after extension of hospice to persons with dementia. This is, you know, they were looking just at people with dementia. The drop was especially large in hospitalizations, including ICU admissions and deaths in the hospital. Not to zero, of course, but about 25 or 30% reduction in each of these categories. And this is of all patients with dementia, not just those receiving hospice services. Similar findings were reported for life-sustaining treatments, again, with a drop of 25% to 33% in each of the measures of feeding tubes, invasive ventilation, blood transfusions, and so on. Reasons for continued use of these practices in persons who are terminally ill with dementia, as happens here, are multifaceted. You know, one that's particularly strong in Asia is a traditional barrier to discussing death and dying as a process. Another is lack of enrollment in palliative care programs, particularly on persons who are managed at home. All of which is an important reminder of the need to discuss prognosis early in chronic illness, especially in dementia, and to follow up that discussion as the disease progresses or as new health declines occur.
I thought this study was fascinating with regard to what it called aggressive care and life-sustaining care, as you highlighted, and I couldn't help but think whether that was the same type of ways of thinking that we would have in the United States. Fascinating article. You know, I once again, I was taken back to my geriatric fellowship with this article, as I cared for a number of older adults who were from different countries, mostly European. But there's a great difference in the approach of end-of-life care in the, for example, in the UK compared to, say, Russia. You know, almost diametrically opposed considerations. Mm-hmm. I have to wonder, you know, as the topic of end-of-life evolves, you know, the care evolves, you know, as an important function of medical care, whether all countries will begin to merge into a common belief that end-of-life care should be quality, comfortable, and without the use of acute or hospital interventions.
Well, it does make sense to me. You know, many of the differences we observe across cultures, you know, have to do with where they are in the continuum between being paternalistic and wanting to have shared decision-making. You know, I mean, 50 years ago, we were quite paternalistic and we didn't really do the kind of shared decision-making we do now. Marcus, and I think different cultures are kind of moving in different directions and moving in that direction at different paces.
Dr. Sloan, you know, I had one more question after reviewing these articles, and maybe our listeners would also notice this. You know, it may be just me, but I have noticed that there are a significant number of PhDs, as opposed to MDs specifically, as authors on these international papers. In fact, the first paper had one MD and I think five PhDs. In the United States, we tend to think of PhDs for either basic science or more social science type research. Is there a different meaning internationally when it comes to clinical work and those who have a PhD?
Well, that's an interesting question, Wayne. You know, JAMDA publishes a lot of what we call health services research, as well as larger studies with sophisticated analyses. Often this requires expertise that is more common among PhDs or MD PhDs, which are more common in Europe and Asia than here in the States. Also, geriatricians around the world are so busy with clinical work, they have less time to do research than non-clinicians like PhDs. This is a sore point for me as an editor, because I really like more practical reviews and research articles by clinicians, and who often have the best questions, but they're a lot harder to come by.
Yeah, I'll also say as we wrap up here that, you know, my initial question at the beginning of the show really has been answered, or at least by this issue and the applicability of international research to other countries like the United States. You know, I really appreciated the comparisons listed in the articles. You know, this is what we do. This is what, for example, the United States does. It really makes it seem at the end of the day, Dr. Sloan and Dr. Brown, that we are all working together, truly, in the care of the older adult.
Very much so, I would say. You know, and you know, many of these other countries still look to us for methods and method development and for measures and this type of thing. So we got to keep our engine going so that we'll continue to be in the lead, but we also have to listen to the others because there's a lot of good stuff happening.
Under the leadership of co-editors-in-chief, Drs. Philip Sloan and Cheryl Zimmerman, and with the support of editors like Dr. Mallory Brown, the Journal of the American Medical Director Association continues to be an impactful resource in post-acute and long-term care and beyond. Take a look. Dr. Sloan and Dr. Brown, thank you very much for again spending your time with JAMDA on the go.
Thanks, Wayne.
Our pleasure. Very much our pleasure.
References for this podcast can be found at www.jamda.com. And until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for JAMDA on the Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.